Welcome to Jewish Exploration. This is Rabbi David Foreman. The following series is entitled Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Addenda. It consists of six lectures delivered by myself before a live audience in the winter of 2002. The lectures themselves were digitally recorded and then edited to produce the audio series you have before you. I hope you enjoy listening. What we're going to do for the next 3 weeks is to look at a story that is timely, Yetziat Mitzrayim. What I'd like to do is begin, before we look at the text carefully, with some general overall questions about Yetziat Mitzrayim. Then we'll look at the text and begin to ask some questions in there, and then over the next couple of weeks we'll try to put things together. I'd like to begin with a few questions that have always bothered me from a long time ago. The first one does not explicitly have to do with the Exodus from Egypt, but it's a very basic general question. You know, every family has their skeletons in the closet, has the kinds of things that you don't talk about in polite company that are little secrets, the crazy uncle in the closet, you know, in the attic, so to speak, and all of those things. And to the extent that the Jews are one large family, we also have our skeletons in the closet. We also have our little family secrets that we don't like to talk about much. I'm going to be politically incorrect and bring up one of our little family secrets. I know all of you guys are getting nervous, crossing your arms here. But here's the problem. I'm going to share you, pour my heart out to you, because this is a problem that I've always had. You know, early in school, you get the feeling that there are certain questions that you're allowed to ask and certain questions you're not allowed to ask. You just know. Even in schools that attempt or tell you that they are open to intellectual honesty, there's still borderline questions. And if you cross the line, then that's no good. You can't cross the line. So one of those questions that I've always had is the following. We are Americans and we are Jews. And we like to believe that there's no conflict between them. But one of the problems is the following. As Americans, one of the concepts which define what it means to be an American, I mean, what defines what it means to be an American? So belief in what? Democracy, freedom. But one of the core principles, I think at least in the modern age, that defines what it means to be an American is to believe in the fundamental equality of mankind. We call this egalitarianism. We believe that fundamentally all men are created equal. We believe that slavery was a blight upon the American record. It took us a while to figure out that the Constitution, when it meant men, included blacks. When it meant men, included women, women's suffrage. But ultimately, we finally arrived at it, and we got it. You know, that all men, all mankind are created equal. And part of what it means to be an American is subscribe to egalitarianism. As Jews, then, how do we come to grips and look ourselves face to face when we say we're a chosen people? Right? What does it mean to be a chosen people? I mean, God apparently looks at us in some sort of special way. He professes his great love for us. I mean, we're loved because God loved our ancestors, and therefore somehow we get loved more, or we're chosen. I mean, I think that whenever I hear this word, at least as an American, I feel myself start to cringe. You know, it's like, that here I am, I believe that I'm a chosen person, like, come on, what kind of American am I? And if any American would challenge me on it, any non-Jewish American, I'd kind of thumper, you know, well, it doesn't really mean chosen, I mean, sort of chosen, everybody's chosen, you make yourself chosen, you know, as Paul Johnson said, the Jews believed in this ideal and then they made themselves special. And we can come up with politically correct explanations of chosenness, but the question is, you know, what does it really mean? And is there a way to square this? Can we face this in the eye? Is there a way to really be an American and to really be a Jew as far as chosenness? Or are you basically just going to sort of compromise one or the other and live in this sort of state of tension in our heads? How is it that we view chosenness? How is it that we define chosenness? Now, the reason why I say that this is related to our discussion of the Exodus is because I believe that while the Torah does not explicitly use the language of chosenness with reference to the Exodus, I do believe that that's a sub-theme that underlies much of the story, and that much of the story is only understandable when you understand that on some level this is about chosenness. One of the things I'd like to do, and I'll explain to you why I believe that to be true in a moment, but one of the overarching goals that I would like to get out of these next 3 weeks is to try to, through a study of the Exodus, try to arrive at an understanding of chosenness that makes sense, and to re-examine whether we can be real Americans and real Jews at the same time, or whether we need to make a choice between them, and if so, what choice ought we make? So we're going to take a look at those questions, and that will be one of our goals over the next 3 weeks. Now let me tell you why I think this is relevant to the Exodus, and why I think this is a sub-theme that underlies the Exodus story. There's something about the specialness of Israel, which is very important to God when it comes to the Exodus. How do you know it? You know it because in the first speech, the first communication, really, that God ever has with Moses at the burning bush, he tells him that. Moshe Rabbeinu is told that there is something special about the Jews, and it is that specialness that is causing God to, on some level, to decide to have these people go free. I'm referring to chapter 4, verse 22. You can look in Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, Perek Dalad, Pasuk Chaf Beis. I'll read it. Va'amarta al Paro, you should say to Pharaoh, Ko Amar Hashem, thus says God. By the way, a great thing to do for this course, if you're interested in critical reading, is while you're going through this course, every week, watch a third of the Spielberg deal, Prince of Egypt, you know? And then, no, really, and compare things as we go along. Because if you want to see a really politically correct version of the Exodus, all you have to do is watch that film. And it's amazing how many things you get in the Exodus that really are not so kosher from an American point of view, which the film softens and attempts to be accurate, but softens very much. One of them, of course, is that as Americans, what's the great line from the Exodus? Let my people go, right? You all know it, right? But the other half of the verse, actually, which is there in Hebrew, somehow never makes it into that proclamation, which is what's the verse in Hebrew? Shlach et ami v'yavduni, right? And let them serve me, right? It doesn't say in Spielberg's film, let my people go that they may serve me, right? That doesn't sound particularly, you know, doesn't have a ring to it. So that got cut out. But another one of the verses which get cut out is this one, and this for sure got left at the cutting floor of Spielberg's film. And here it is. Vamarta al Paro, and thus says to Pharaoh, Ko Amar Hashem, thus says God, B'ni B'chori Yisrael. My firstborn son is the Jewish people. Now, let's just stop there for a moment. My firstborn son is the Jewish people, and therefore I want them free. Now, that seems to be, again, this declaration of specialness as regards the Jewish people. They are God's firstborn son. Now, notice, by the way, the word for Bechor in Hebrew is phonetically related to what other word? Bechar. Not grammatically related, but phonetically related. Right? So there's no grammatical relationship between these worlds, but there's a phonetic relationship. These letters would have to interchange. Bechor, firstborn, is related to the Hebrew term Bechar, which means chosen. Not related grammatically, but it sounds the same, right? Is there a connection between what it means to be God's firstborn son and what it means to be the Am HaNivchar, right, the chosen nation? Are these things related? And while we're on the subject, it seems that as far as the Exodus is concerned, this notion of Bechor is for some reason very, very key to the story. And I'll show you why it's key in a moment. But what does it mean that we are the firstborn son of God? First of all, it's nonsense, right? God has lots of children. So let's say, all right, so the children of the nations. So we're God's firstborn nation. Is it true? No. We're not the firstborn nation. It's not like God said, you know, Adam, you're a Jew, and everybody else, you know, we'll get around to them, to their nationalities. No, the Jews are not the first nation. I don't think they're the first nation to arrive. So in what sense are they the firstborn nation? What does it mean that we are the firstborn son of God? It doesn't seem to be true. Now, you could say that God is just using this metaphorically. Right? I mean, it's just a nice metaphor. God doesn't really mean it's true in any sort of serious way. He just means that the Jews are nice, and they're good people, and they're special. But if you continue reading chapter 4, verse 22, which I showed you, into the next pasuk, you begin to feel that the Torah means this very, very seriously. That the Torah is quite certain, in a very serious way, that the Jews really are the Bechor of God. How do you know? Read the next verse and tell me how you know from the next verse that God is taking this notion very seriously and doesn't just see it as mere poetics. Okay, go ahead. Right. Listen to this, right? Here's the, how's this for poetry. Oh, you know, I think the Jews are like a driven leaf. They're like dew on the first petals of a rose. They're like my firstborn child. And come to think of it, if you don't let them go, I'll kill your firstborn child. Right? I mean, that doesn't really have much of a ring to it. God is just casting about for nice poetic metaphors or similes, right? God seriously thinks this is true because he's going to kill, right, millions of Egyptians because he thinks this is true. He says, you want to know what it means not to have a firstborn child? I'll show you what it means not to have a firstborn child. You see what it's like without a firstborn child. I'll kill all of yours. Right? So the problem is that God is not just using this in a poetic way. God is very serious that whatever a firstborn child is to Pharaoh or to any Egyptian, God says, the Jews are my firstborn child. And he takes it very, very seriously. So, and by the way, this is the only plague that Pharaoh gets forewarning from at the very beginning, right? This is way before any of the plagues. Even before any of the plagues comes, there's a warning to Pharaoh that ultimately, if he resists, it's going to come to Makat V'Chorot, it's going to come to the 10th plague, to the destruction of the firstborn, right? So again, why is it that God takes this so seriously? Let me ask you this. Pesach. Imagine that this holiday did not have a name. Okay? There's no name. Right? And now we're all convened. God has convened a special committee, a naming committee, for this holiday. Okay, the Jews have gone free. You know the story. Right? And the problem is this holiday doesn't have a name. So we're getting together now, and we've got like 3 minutes to come up with a very good name for this holiday. Can someone give me some suggestions for a nice, concise name that really sums this up? What's this day all about? What should we call it? Exodus Day.
Freedom Day.
Freedom Day. Independence Day, that has a nice ring to it, right? We know about that, right? 4th of July, right? This is our 4th of July. It's Independence Day. We can call it Yom HaAtzmaut. That's right. That would be terrific, right? Okay, now what do you say? Now one of you in the back of the room says, no, I have the perfect name for it. Let's call it Passover. And you say, well, you know, that doesn't really have much of a ring to it, you know? Passover, I mean, what's it referring to anyway? You say, no, you don't understand. You have to look at the verses really carefully, you see? Because in the last plague, right? So when the Jews, when God was like killing everybody, so there he was going to kill everybody, including the Jews too, unless they put this blood on the door, right? And when they did, so the angel passed over our houses. So let's name it Passover. What's wrong with this? You tell me an objection to this plan. It's a good idea, great name. What's the problem with this? It's just a small piece of the puzzle. If you're trying to name something, right? You're trying to take out the main theme, the main idea, what's it all about, and you give it a name, right? But to focus on one little detail, now it's true it's an important detail, right? Because if the Jews get killed, right, then there ain't nobody to redeem. Now that's true, right? But still, it doesn't focus on what the day is all about. In other words, what are we celebrating? We're celebrating that the Jews didn't get killed, but what you see is that for some reason the Torah considers Pesach the best name for this holiday. And what did Pesach mean? What does Pesach really mean? It's the time when their firstborn got killed, but our firstborn didn't get killed. Again, comes back to the notion of the firstborn. The firstborn becomes central, the theme of the firstborn becomes central to the theme of the holiday. Another indication that the theme of being a firstborn is central is what the whole name of Pesach is all about. Another indication that it's true. Let's say we are now creating a great memorial for this holiday, right? What are we going to do? We have this great idea, right? This is the religious committee. We're God's religious committee, right? We're convened to give God great ideas for to put in his Torah, right? So we're nominating different mitzvahs. So we have this fantastic idea. Here's our idea. We're going to get these little boxes, right? And we want people to wear them in the morning, right? We want the people to wear them every day. We'll put some on the head. We'll put some on the arms. And the deal is this, right? The Torah, big scroll, very hard to lug around and carry around and all of that. But it's got some important things in it. So what we want to do is kind of take the really important stuff out of the Torah and put it in this thing that we're going to call phylacteries, rough name, but that's just what we're going to call them, right? And we'll bind ourselves with them. It'll be symbolic. We'll feel like we're recommitting ourselves every day to these tenets. But we have to decide, what are we going to put into these things? So give me some nominations. What should we put in here? Shema, you can't beat the Shema, right? I mean, it's so pithy, it's nice, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So Shema wins, and Shema is in tefillin. The Ten Commandments, you might say, a good idea, right? One second. It's a good idea. Let's put the Ten Commandments in tefillin, right? Ten Commandments actually doesn't make it in tefillin. The Gemara has a discussion, actually, about making the Ten Commandments part of Kriyat Shema, right? That originally it should be part of Shema that you say every day. And the reason why they didn't do it was because they thought that if you made the Ten Commandments part of Shema, then everyone would think that you only had to observe those Ten Commandments. They didn't want to give anybody excuses for that, so they left the Ten Commandments out. But otherwise, that would be a really nice idea, to put the Ten Commandments in. All right, so that would be in. But what if, again, we're in this religious nominating committee, and what if after we have the Shema, and then we put in the Ahavta is pretty important, right? You should love God with all your heart, with all your soul, be dedicated to Him, we put that in. We put a little of the Hayam Shema in. But what happens if somebody in the back of the room says, I know what we should do. Let's put the following in. Chapter 13, verse 10 looks like a wonderful thing to put in to tefillin. So I got a little bit of space, but there's probably enough room for this. I'm sorry. Chapter 13, verse 11. Ready? B'haya ki yivyacha Hashem el eretz haknani, when it will happen that God will bring us to the land of the Canaanites, kasher nishba l'chol avasecha, when the son Allah, that as he promised you and gives it to you, v'avarta kol peter rechem l'Hashem, v'chol peter sheger behem asher yeh l'cha hazacharim l'Hashem. You should give all firstborn, the first of the womb, to God of all of your animals and offer them as offerings, all the male firstborn, offer them as offerings upon the altar. Now, v'chol peter chamor, a chamor, a donkey, you're not going to offer on the altar. We don't offer donkeys on the altar. But any firstborn chamor, tifdebaseh, what you should do is you should redeem it with a sheep. So if you've got a firstborn donkey, you take a sheep and you say, the kedusha, the holiness of the donkey, should now go on the sheep. So the sheep is going to be a replacement for the donkey. And if you don't replace the donkey, then you offer the sheep. If you don't replace the donkey, you can't offer the donkey up on the altar. So va'arapto, you should break its neck and kill the donkey. V'chol pror adam v'vanecha tifte, but all of your male children, you should also redeem, and you don't kill them. If you don't redeem them, you just redeem them. Okay, let's put that in tefillin. Silence. Nobody's voting yes for this, right? But believe it or not, folks, this is in tefillin, right? Now, come on. This is the best thing you could think of putting in tefillin, this business about the donkey and the and then tomorrow you're going to ask Lemor Mazos, what's up? Your kid's going to say Va'amarta Elav, and you could say B'chozek Yad Hotzioni Hashem Mitzrayim Beit Avadim. This symbolizes God took me out of Mitzrayim. Va'yaki Shapar LaShalchein Va'yarog Hashem Kol B'chor Meis Mitzrayim. When Pharaoh didn't let us go, so he killed out all the firstborn. Min B'chor Adam Ad B'chor Ema, from firstborn animals to firstborn children. That's why I sacrifice all firstborn as a sheep, and I redeem all of my firstborn. And then, and these should be part of tefillin. They should be for a sign on your hand and on your head. That, with an outstretched arm, God took us out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt. But that's a pretty funny sign, isn't it? I mean, it's a strange sign. But again, for some reason, the sign that the Torah decides to give us about Yetziat Mitzrayim, again, focuses on this notion of Bechor, right? That all of their Bechoros were killed, all of our Bechoros were saved, and that is what it's all about. So for some strange reason, one of the very important sub-themes of this whole story is this notion of Bechor. I think if we figure out what it means that we're the firstborn son of God, whatever it is that means, whatever the Torah means by it, we may be well on our way to understanding what it means to be a chosen people. We'll also be well on our way towards understanding what the agenda of the Exodus was on some kind of level. Again, rather than hide in the shadows from the issue of chosenness, I'd like to sort of confront it directly. This is the last we're going to speak of it until the end of class number 3, but this is something I want you to keep in the back of your heads. It will be an agenda. What is it that we mean when we talk about ourselves being a chosen people? Yes?
God just spent a whole book telling us that chosenness has nothing to do with birth order. Why would all of a sudden, after the whole book of Bereishit, it suddenly become important that he called Bnei Israel firstborn?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Cass's point is, just to elucidate, that that when she says that God just spent a whole book telling us that chosenness or specialness doesn't have to do with birth order, she's referring to the pervasive theme of sibling rivalry in Genesis, and the notion that over and over again it is the younger child that supersedes the older child and seems to be the special child in at least God's eyes or a father's eyes or something like that. However, just interestingly enough, one might ask, what was the struggle between Yaakov and Esav? One aspect of the struggle was not just who's going to be special, but it was, could the younger perhaps be the Bechor? In other words, the struggle was over the birthright. The struggle was over who would be considered the Bechor, who would be considered the firstborn son. So it wasn't just that the person who wasn't the firstborn could be special, but the struggle in that case was, could I be considered firstborn even if I'm not technically firstborn? Again, with Joseph, the struggle between Joseph and the brothers, to an extent, is a struggle over who is going to be considered the firstborn. Right? Now, Joseph is almost last born, right? However, in some respect, he's firstborn, which is what?
Rachel.
He's the firstborn of Rachel, right? And that seems to be the way Yaakov seems to deal with him, and the other brothers think that he's usurping it. Again, with Ephraim and Manasseh, right? With Ephraim and Manasseh, again, right? The younger child gets elevated, but gets elevated and almost becomes the quasi-Bechor. So I'm not so sure that Breishit tells us that birth order doesn't matter. Breishit might be telling us that you can become a virtual Bechor, so to speak, even if you are not a technical Bechor, perhaps. But I don't know the answer to that, but that's a good question. In any case, we'll have to, in response to Cass's question, we would have to see at the end of all of this whether our definition of the Jews are that they are a technical firstborn or are they a virtual firstborn. Which one of the kinds of firstborns are they? Are they the Esav type or are they the Yaakov type? Are they the younger child seeking to become something that they really aren't? Or are they all along this firstborn child? Okay. By the way, I'd like to just spend a moment focusing on the 10th plague. The 10th plague seems to be special. Why is it special? It's special because the holiday gets named for what happens in the 10th plague. It's special because what goes into tefillin is a remembrance of what happened in the 10th plague. It's also special for a couple other reasons. And we're going to have to focus on the 10th plague to really understand the story. One of the ways in which it is special is that it is the only plague for which the Jewish people was not granted automatic diplomatic immunity, right? You know, like the diplomats, they can park wherever they want, license plates, right? This is, the Jews were diplomats, right? When it came to the plague of blood, if you were in Goshen, right, so everything was honky-dory, there was no problem with the water in Goshen, right? All the water faucets had water in them, there was no blood. There were no frogs in Goshen. When it came time for darkness, there's no darkness in Goshen. The Medrash goes so far as to say if the Jews went out of Goshen, they could see while the Egyptians couldn't see. There was a sort of subjective reality. For the Egyptians it was dark, for the Jews it was light. So the question is, if you are going to length to make sure that the Jews get diplomatic immunity, you couldn't finish the job and give them diplomatic immunity for the last plague, why couldn't they get diplomatic immunity for the last plague? Also, another question to ask is, if you look at the 10th plague, the 10th plague actually is a turning point in the entire Torah. How is the 10th plague a turning point in the entire Torah? I'm talking now about the style in which the Torah is written. How is the 10th plague a turning point in the style in which the Torah is written? You can break up the Torah into roughly narrative sections and commandment sections, right? Somebody asks you what the Torah is, it's not just a book of commandments, it's also a book of narratives. It's not just a book of narratives, it's also a book of commandments, right? This is the first extended commandment section in the Torah, beginning with HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, this is your month, right? And then beginning from there into all the detailed laws of the Pesach offering, over and over again. It's rather remarkable, because the entire Yetziat Mitzrayim, indeed, the entire Genesis, to this point, with very few exceptions, one little exception, a little bit with Gid HaNashe. In other words, if you look at the Sefer HaChinuch, where he goes through all the mitzvahs of the Torah, so in Genesis, there's virtually no mitzvahs, there's just Gid HaNashe, the sciatic nerve, which we don't eat because that was where Yaakov, the angel touched Yaakov, so we don't eat it. And then the Torah makes passing reference to it when it says, Al kein lo yachil Yisrael gitan asheh, and that's why the Jews don't eat gitan asheh. But it doesn't even command it at that time. It just, in passing, says that's why. The first time the Jews are directly commanded is here with the 10th plague. They have specific commands, and they get a lot of them. And the style of the Torah with commands is often to get into very, very detailed analysis of offerings and commands and all of that. And it seems you see the very stark contrast. You're hearing this gripping narrative and you're really interested in what's going on. You're finally getting up to the climax where things are coming to a head. And then we take a break into detailed laws. There has to be a sheep and there's got to be a firstborn. It has to be a one-year-old sheep. And when you put them on the spit and roast them over the fire, it's got to be the knees over the head and you got to roast it and you can't boil it because if you boil it, it's bad. And everyone's got to eat it together in a chabura and they have to count people into the chabura, and if you don't count people into the chabura, it's bad. They've all got to get together in groups. If you can't finish the meat in the first night, you can't leave any over. All of these laws, right? Very strange. You think, okay, let's get back to the story. But for some reason, this is the beginning of that whole narrative section. So why is that? And if you look at this mitzvah section, an interesting challenge, which I'll leave you for homework as something to think about, is, I'll be very impressed if you can get this, can you go through all of the mitzvot that relate to the Karban Pesach, to the Passover offering, and see if you can find a common denominator between them. Okay? Go through all the mitzvot and ask yourself, is there anything that links these mitzvot together? Right? Let me give you a couple examples. You can read the text inside if you like. Right? But some examples. Well, you tell me, what are some examples of the laws of the Passover offering? I mentioned some of them.
Jews can eat it.
Okay, only Jews can eat it, and an RL can't eat it. Now, someone who's not been circumcised can't eat it, which means even a Jew, male Jew who's not been circumcised, can't eat it. Okay? What? Can't leave it until the morning. It has to be a one-year-old sheep. Okay? They all have to eat it together in a group. There's no such thing as people signing on at the last minute and saying, can I have some of your Passover offering? That's necha leminuyav, as the Gemara says. They all have to count themselves into a large group beforehand. Okay, you have to eat it b'chipazon, right? You have to eat it in haste, or you're supposed to eat it in haste. Good. What else? Al matzot umrarim. You have to eat it together with matzot and bitter herbs. You have to eat it together. Tliyesh. Has to be roasted, so we have the recipe, right? You're not allowed to just prepare this thing in any way you want. So you can't go home and boil it. If you boil it in a pot, so then you've got to throw it out. It has to be tliyesh, and it has to be barbecued over a spit in a certain way, all scrunched up together, right?
You can't break the bone.
Good. Etzel lo tishberu bo. You're not allowed to break any bones. It's the only offering that has this. So you're not allowed to break any bones. So you got some food for thought here. You can think about this. Is there any, right? I'm sorry for the pun there. But the idea is there anything that unites all of these various commands that makes them, that gives them some sort of common theme, or do these not make any sense? Okay? So again, the idea of Bechor, as expressed in Makat Bechorot, becomes a main theme of the whole story. What is going on? One of the things we'll have to do is to look at the 10th plague more carefully. But you can look on your own to try and see if you can figure out a common theme in all of those commandments. Okay, let's move away from Bechor to look at the story in a little bit more detail and to ask some general questions about the story. Again, on a very general level, before we get into too much specifics in the text, let me ask you one very general question. Nowadays they have these computer games where you can play God, right? And you get like Civilization, right? And some of the other ones, Age of Empires, right? These are the big simulation games which are really hot on the computer gamers list because you're all powerful and you can do whatever it is that you want. So we're going to play a very quick computer simulation game of the Exodus. Imagine you're going back in time and you're God and you can do the Exodus. So here's your objective. Your objective is your favorite people are enslaved by the world's greatest empire, right? And you have to get them free. All right? Here are your weapons, right? You're God. You can do whatever you want, right? You've got thunder and lightning. You've got atom bombs. You've got neutron bombs. You've got frogs. You've got lice. You name it. You've got it. And normally there are constraints upon God using these up, right? He has to be very judicious about his use of miracles. But in the Exodus, all bets are off. There's no constraints. You can do whatever you want, use any miracles you want. Okay, so tell me how you're going to do it. Let's try and do this as quickly, as efficiently as we possibly can. We've got this stubborn monarch, Pharaoh, right? He just doesn't listen. You've already asked him nicely, right? And he's just said, no, I don't believe in God. That's kind of ruffled your feathers a little bit. And now you've got to really make this happen. How are you going to do this quickly and efficiently? Is it going to take you 10 plagues, folks? No. So the question is, God obviously is not interested in concision and speed and effectiveness here. Because if God is interested in speed and effectiveness, how would he do it?
Start at number 10.
Kill Pharaoh. Well, kill Pharaoh might not have worked, right? Because then Pharaoh's son gets on board, right? So that may not have worked. What could you have done to for sure get those Jews free? So plague number 10 in the beginning? Okay, maybe. Okay, that could have done it. What else? Really easy, folks. Just use your imagination. Okay, just take the Jews out. How could you do it? What should you do? How would you take them out? The Egyptians are going to kill them. What would you do?
Set up a force field around them.
Right. Easy way to do it. You could set up a force field around the Jews, and you say, okay, Egyptians are not allowed to hurt Jews. They can throw their spears. It's just going to clink against this invisible shield. And it actually happened, right? It happened later on at the sea when God actually intervened between the war machine of the Egyptians and the Jews. Why couldn't he have done that in plague number one, right? He could have, right, if he wanted to. Or in plague number seven or so, right? Or no, sorry, Choshech, nine. Choshech would have been a great opportunity, right? No one can see except for the Jews. Just take them out. Right? So and there God had the chance because it was already dark and he didn't take the chance. So very clearly, God is not interested in doing this as efficiently as possible, apparently. Now the question is, then that seems to speak of another agenda. But then the question is, what is that other agenda? So you might say, to add drama, right? That he wants to make it Spielberg-esque. However, I would argue that that's probably our own modern prejudice that we think in terms of movies. Was God interested in drama? He was going to make thousands of people suffer, millions of people suffer in slavery longer because he wanted good drama? I don't know. You could say that. It does make for a nicer story, right? But the question is, you know, why? What exactly are the constraints here? What I'd like to do is to try to look at the rest of the text and through over the next couple of weeks, try to constantly come back to this question, what was God's agenda? It seems that it was not just that God has an agenda to get these Jews free. Because if the agenda is just to get them free, there's a lot easier ways to do that. Things are designed for sub-agenda also. And exactly how do we define that sub-agenda? And was it successful or was it unsuccessful? Now, there's another related issue we need to address here, and that is that for some reason or another, if you look at Jewish holidays, look at the Sabbath, look at the three festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, look at Jewish life, look at Kiddush on Shabbos, look at the Shema that we say every morning and every evening, the Exodus plays a profound role in all of these holidays and in all of these basic life events. Almost everything that we do is Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim, is in one form or another intended to help us recall the Exodus from Egypt. Why is it that the Exodus is so central to Jewish life? Why?
It's more like a birthday.
Okay, so you might say that the Exodus is important because it's our birthday. It's our national birthday. This is the day that we as a people were born. We're happy about it. God's happy about it. Okay, but we don't say, but it would be very narcissistic, I think, to say that our birthday is so important that we always have to constantly celebrate it. For example, imagine parents who say, you know what, you have a birthday once a year, my little beautiful one, but instead of you just doing this once a year, I want you to celebrate your birthday every week. Celebrate your birthday. I'm so happy that you're around. I'll give you presents. And then and every third day, you know, and then your birthday day, you'll celebrate it. Everything you do when you go to school, you wake up in the morning, remember your birthday. Say it every morning. Say it every night. Remember how wonderful it is that you were born. You are raising a narcissistic little brat, right?
And then, so...
Well, are we? Are we? That's right. So we're chosen. This is about us. Hey, I'm a Jew, right? This is about me, right? Look who you're. Well, maybe. But I don't think the Torah is ultimately about narcissism. So I think there's something else going on here, right? It's not just, hey, this is the day that you were born. Okay, I know you guys have questions, but I want to move on to touch on some other stuff before we have to call it a night. Okay. Feisty little ones you guys are. Let's talk about Pharaoh's will for a moment. Okay, this is a very problematic little issue which we're going to need to deal with. Okay, Pharaoh's will. First of all, let's go back to our civilization motto. You're playing God. Okay, let me ask you something. Do you need this guy Pharaoh to consent before you're going to get the Jews out? Absolutely not. Can you do this without Pharaoh consenting? Absolutely. Just freeze the Egyptians, take out the Jews, it's all over. However, there seems to be this unwritten rule in the Exodus story that unless Pharaoh consents, the Jews aren't going anywhere. I mean, it just seems to be these are the rules of the game. Why? Because over and over again, God sends Moses to Pharaoh to beg and to offer and to cajole and to bargain and to intimidate, and it's all designed to have Pharaoh utter those magic words, "You can all go now." And there's these ridiculous bargaining sessions where Pharaoh says, "Well, I think I'll let you go, but who do you want to go?" So Moshe says, and by the way, there's this crazy pretense that we're only going for 3 days. Did that ever bother you? I mean, why does God have to like say we're only going for 3 days? Why lie? I mean, you can't, it's beneath God. I mean, just say what it is that you want already and get him to go. You want it for 3 days, what, and then you're going to sneak out? You know, what's going on? And then Pharaoh can say,
"We only want the West Bank."
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what it's like. I mean, it does seem beneath him. And notice how the 3 days never made it into the Prince of Egypt. Why? Because it was beneath God to insist on, you know, 3 days. Come on, let my people go. God stands up and just says this is the way. But there's this charade going on about the 3 days. And Pharaoh, we really want to go. And by the way, he never says we're leaving. Right? What does he say? And that's why Shalach et Ami, by the way, is so misleading. Because Shalach et Ami, let my people go, sounds like the demand was, we're leaving and going to Canaan. But it's not true. The demand was, Shalach et Ami v'yavdeni, let my son go so he can serve me for a couple days and then come back. That's not very, I mean, that sounds like a ghetto mentality. I mean, why don't you just leave already? So it seems very strange that we're only doing this for 3 days, and that was the request. Then we have these ridiculous bargaining sessions where Pharaoh says, "Gee, well, you're going to offer some offerings. All right, so who do you need to go? I'll let your males go, because they're going to be the ones doing the offering." Moshe says, "No, God says that he wants everybody to go." Right? So then he says, "Well, you know, leave your children behind." "No, the children have to see it too." Right? And then Benarenu, Vizkunenu, the old ones have to come. And then Pharaoh says, "All right, fine, but just take the sheep that you're going to offer and leave behind the rest of your cattle." Chas v'shalom, Moshe says. I mean, who knows what God's going to ask? I mean, maybe he'll want to sacrifice giraffes. We have to take our giraffes too with us. I mean, you never know what God will ask till we get him there. God's not telling us. He's keeping it a secret. There's this little game going on. And then Pharaoh says, "Ah, I've had enough." Then another plague comes, and then Pharaoh says, "Okay, fine, you can take a giraffe, but just leave behind something." "No, we can't leave behind anything. We'll be back. We don't worry." I mean, there's this ridiculous bargaining session going on when it's all unnecessary. God does not need Pharaoh to say yes. But for some reason, unless Pharaoh is saying yes, nobody's moving anywhere. Why does God have this sort of self-imposed restriction? That is question number one. But that is not the only problem regarding Pharaoh's will. There's another problem regarding Pharaoh's will. The other great problem with Pharaoh's will is the old hardening the heart deal, right? In the middle of this, another thing which, by the way, never made it into the Prince of Egypt, right, which is that God decides halfway through this that when Pharaoh finally says the Jews can go, so God hardens his heart and seems to get Pharaoh to change his mind, right, and says that he's no longer going to let the Jews go. Now, there are some problems with this, okay? The most obvious problem with this is that there's a moral problem. How can you go punishing a guy that you're interfering with their free will and making them do what you want to do, and then you punish them for not listening to you? I mean, that doesn't seem very fair at all. That's like setting your kid up and getting them to do X because they think you want to do X, and then punishing them because you set them up. This is just not kosher. So problem number one is the moral problem. How does God get off punishing Pharaoh? "Oh, boy, look at you guys. You're really going to be destroyed because you didn't listen to me." When God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Now, all the medieval commentators struggle with this question, but here's the problem. There's the moral problem. The moral problem is, how can you punish somebody who wants to listen to you, but you're not letting them listen to you? So there's a machlokas, there's Ramban, and there's the Rambam about it. Basically, the Ramban says that, well, Pharaoh was such a bad guy, right, that the worst punishment you can give for a guy who's really bad is to do what? What's the worst punishment you can dream of? Death. What's even worse than death?
Living death.
Living death. What's even worse than living death?
Free choice.
Right. The worst thing is not to become a human being and to lose your power to choose. Right? That, we say, the ultimate definition of what it means to be human is to make independent choices in the world. The worst thing you can possibly do to a human being is make them continue to live but be unable to make free will choices. Right? The Ramban says that was the ultimate punishment for Pharaoh. When you get to be so bad, so God deprives you of free will. By the way, if you were a psychologist, right, and if you saw that, you could see this from a psychological angle as simply a fact about the human, about human existence. For example, right, when I do something bad, and I do it again, and I do it again, and I do it again, what am I doing to myself? I'm habituating myself, and ultimately I essentially lose my free will about it. Now, it doesn't mean I technically lose my free will. I still can choose not to do it, but I am, in effect, taking away my free will for that thing because I'm conditioning myself to have a conditioned response, and to that extent, I no longer have free will. For example, how do Jews respond, if we believe in free will, how do we respond to modern psychology that said, to the Freudians, who say that there's no free will because there's this great struggle between the id and the superego and these great forces and you're stuck in the middle, right? So how do we respond to that? We ignore it. How do we respond to the Skinner, to the behaviorist people who say that it's all about conditioning? Behavioral conditioning works. You go out, you can look in the Yellow Pages, you find lots of behavioral psychologists who will tell you, yeah, you can regulate people and you give them enough positive reinforcement for this, enough negative reinforcement for that, and voila, you don't have any more free will. So how is it that we respond to that? We say we have our heads in the sands and we think people have free will when there's all this psychological evidence that you can condition people, and then there's genetics, and genetics say that you have X, Y, and Z and programs you, and there's nurture, and there's nature versus nurture, but either it's nature or it's nurture. Somebody's influencing you. Whence free will, right? How do we deal with that? So the traditional Jewish response to that is you have what's known, Rabbi Dessler calls it the Nekudat HaBechira, right, which is the point of free will. But that's what it says. We do not believe in a very fancy, far-flung theory in free will. We believe a very narrow theory, that there's a very narrow window of free will, which is that in effect, although technically I can choose to do anything, at any moment in time, I only have certain points that I'm struggling over, and everything else is basically determined. I am determined by genetics to do this. I'm determined by behavior to do that. But it's like a ladder. Right? And what I can do is I have free will because I can move up a ladder or down a ladder or across on a ladder, and then there are all these influences upon me, but there is still a point at which I'm struggling with that I can succeed or not succeed at that moment. To illustrate what it is that I'm talking about, let me give you the following example. Imagine for a moment we have a klal in the Torah, a general principle in the Torah, that people... That if you avoid doing an avera, if you avoid committing transgressions, that's as if you've done a mitzvah, and you're rewarded as if you've done a mitzvah. Okay, just take this for granted for a moment. Now, I have a fantastic idea of how all of you can win a straight ticket to Olam Haba, right? After 120 years, you can go straight upstairs, because I'm going to now put you on a program of avoiding averas all day long. Here's what you're going to do. Tomorrow, instead of going to work or doing whatever it is you're normally going to do, you're going to go out in the freezing cold to the corner of Hook Lane and Reisterstown Road, one of these busy streets where, you know, it's sort of difficult to cross, and you are now going to watch little old ladies walk across the street, and you are going to avoid mugging them as they walk across the street. I mean, because they have a few dollars in their pocket, right? And you are now going to decide at every second that some vulnerable little person walks across the street, that you are not, you say, Hineni muchanu mezumen l'kayem mitzvah, here I am, I'm ready to kayem this mitzvah l'shem Hashem, I'm avoiding the avera, I could mug them, and I'm not mugging them. And then you just see that little brownie point go up, light up in Olam Haba, right? And you just collect your brownie points. And then, after 120 years, you're going to get to Olam Haba. God will say, what have you done with your life? You'll say, just look at those brownie points, God. Just see them. They're right over there. I have 347,931 times that I could have mugged people on the corner of Hooks Lane and Reisterstown Road. Aren't you proud of me? What will God say? God will say, sorry, you wasted your life. Right? I'm not impressed. But I have all these brownie points. Right? What would God say? That was not your struggle. Right? You did not struggle over whether to mug somebody or not mug somebody. If you had grown up in the slums and you were struggling with thievery and a drug culture and all of that, and you were the kind of person that would mug people and you avoided mugging people now and then, I'd be impressed and I'd give you some brownie points. But that wasn't your struggle. In other words, that was below you're Nekudat al-Khira. If you're on a ladder, if here's your ladder, and you're over here, right? So mugging people is somewhere down there. Well, you're already conditioned by behavior, genetics, family, environment, not to do that. So you don't have any free will. You didn't make any choices. It was also already taken for granted. You wasted your time on that corner. And then if you continue up here, right, you could say that there are great tzaddikim, you know, that used to meditate for 3 days before Yom Kippur, this great introspection. They'd fast and meditate and look inside themselves and see, and all the way from the month of Elul. Elul was different. Every day was was this great self-introspection. You don't do that, right? You take it a little bit easier and you start thinking about Yom Kippur maybe a few days before Yom Kippur finally gets to you, and you feel guilty. So during Slichot, you pay attention for a little bit, but then it sort of falls off the radar map until Rosh Hashanah. Then you feel bad, and then, you know, you remember it for a day or two, but then Yom Kippur comes, you finally haven't done any New Year's resolutions. So God's going to come to you after 120 years, and he's going to say to you, how come you didn't fast like the Kotzker Rebbe, right? And you'll answer, I'm not the Kotzker Rebbe, right? But if he asks, how come you didn't think about Yom Kippur a couple days earlier? You won't have much to say. Why? Because that was your Nekudat HaBechira. That was your struggle, right? You're not going to be tested for what you didn't do up here. You're not going to be tested for what you did do down here. It's the stuff in the middle that counts. And it's that intersection of genetics and personal life and all of that where we all struggle. Now, you're not stuck there, right? Because if you successfully choose over and over again, you can condition yourself, and that becomes a conditioned response, and you can move up in the ladder to a new thing which you struggle with, and hopefully we're moving up and we're not moving down. But that's what it's all about. It's about moving up and not moving down, right? So you can say to yourself, that, by the way, I think is the answer when people say, who is better? Somebody who was born into this wonderful aristocratic Torah family who spends his whole life studying and all of that, and slips away, or it's not fair because look at his upbringing and look at his education, and here this guy's in the slums and he's a drug dealer and he's on crack cocaine and his mother's he struggled and he this and he that. So how could God judge these people in fairness? I think the answer is that God doesn't judge you objectively, right, on how far you up are on the ladder, but God judges, right, what was your life about? Was your life about going up the ladder or going down the ladder? Right, if the guy who grew up in the crack household, pulled himself up by his bootstraps and moved farther up the ladder than somebody who sort of rested on his laurels because he was born into this wonderful family and had this great education, then who's to say who has the higher place in the world to come, right? You don't know. So what the Ramban suggests is that the ultimate, if you view the Ramban from a psychological vantage point, you would say what the Ramban is saying is that the ultimate loss, the ultimate way down the ladder for somebody who's truly evil is to no longer have any free will at all. So that there's no points in the ladder at all which you are left. Everything is a conditioned response. And ultimately, Pharaoh, by choosing badly over and over again, automatically sort of lost his free will. That would be a sort of modern psychological interpretation of it. The Ramban himself sees it as more of an active thing that God took away his free will. But trust me, there's that moral problem which all of the Rishonim deal with, which is, how do we deal with the morality of God taking away your free will? Is it a conditioned response or not? Now, the moral problem is interesting, and it's something which we will consider and we will get back to in our third class. But for the moment, I am concerned with a simple textual problem. Okay? There's another problem with this notion that God is hardening Pharaoh's heart, morality aside. Okay? There's a problem in the structure of the story, okay, based upon what we just said. I just showed you that there seems to be some unwritten rule that the Jews are not going to go free unless Pharaoh gives his consent. Okay? In your mind, that should create for you a whole problem with this notion of these biblical narratives with God hardening free will. What's the problem? You're working against yourself. It's a catch-22. You're pulling at both ends of the rope. In other words, you'd say, God, what do you want from this man already? In other words, what's your rule? Your rule is that Pharaoh's got to say that they want to go, that they want to go. And all you're trying to do is to get Pharaoh to say yes. So you're not letting them go until Pharaoh says yes. So obviously Pharaoh's will is very important to you. You want Pharaoh to say yes. You aren't willing to just disregard him. Well, if so, how come whenever he's ready to say yes, you make him say no? Right? If you're not interested in his will in the first place, so then just why bother? Just freeze him, get him out. If you want to make it dramatic and do 10 plagues, so freeze him, shoot 10 plagues down, and then get him out. Right? But why is it that why are you going to engage in a charade where you're going to try and get Pharaoh to say yes, because you're going to say, unless he says yes, it says nothing. But then once he says yes, you make him say no. Are you interested in his free will, or are you not interested in his free will? the truth is, the issue of Pharaoh's will is extremely complicated. Okay, it's a real toughie. Let me tell you some of the issues that are tough in it, and I'm going to give you the challenge of trying to come up with a coherent reading of what's going on with Pharaoh's will throughout the whole story. Your challenge is going to be to start with plague number one and trace Pharaoh's will and ask yourself, who hardens whose heart when in each of the plagues and why? Okay, let me tell you some of the issues that are difficult. Okay? Issue number one. Do you know when the first time when God unambiguously hardens Pharaoh's heart is? Anyone know what the first time that God unambiguously hardens his heart is? I'll tell you what it is. It's right before the plague of Barad, right before the plague of hail. Okay? Look it up, you'll see. You know what's really strange about this? What's really strange about this is Pharaoh's heart is hardened. So you think his free will is finally taken away. Okay? But immediately after that, Paro is apologetic and seems to act with ultimate free will when he says, no, you're right, I realize I was wrong, God is the tzaddik, that I'm the evil one, and God is the righteous one, and he gives in. So immediately after God hardens his heart, Pharaoh's next response is to give in and let the Jews go. So fascinatingly, for the greatest moment of Pharaoh giving in took place immediately after the first time that God hardened his heart, which seems to be a contradiction. So you think if his heart is finally hardened, he's lost his free will to give in. But actually the first time that he truly gives in is immediately after God hardens his heart. How do you square that? Okay? Then, let me give you another problem with hardening a heart. Take a look at the beginning of Parshat Bo. Chapter 9:34. And Pharaoh hardened his heart, he and his servants. So who hardened whose heart? He hardened his own heart. Now, if you read the next verse, it's ambiguous. Right, and he hardened his heart, and Pharaoh's heart became strong, and he strengthened his heart. The implied person here is God, but then the question is, what does God have to do it for? You could say maybe it's Paro. It's unclear, but then the next verse makes it clear in Parshat Bo. Flip to chapter 10, verse 1. Vayomer Hashem Moshe Bo el Paro ki ani hichbanetli et libo et lev avadav, because I have hardened his heart and he is his servant. This is a flat out contradiction. It just said that Pharaoh hardened his heart, and now it says that God says, no, I'm the one who hardened his heart. So who hardened whose heart? Was it Pharaoh hardening his heart, or was God hardening his heart? Which of these two verses do you trust? You with me? This is Cass's problem. This is a very good problem, something you should struggle with. Immediately before Barad is the first time, apparently, when God hardens his heart or strengthens his heart. This is chapter 9, verse 12. Immediately after that is Barad. In Barad, Pharaoh gives in for the first time. So question number one is, how could Pharaoh give in Barad when right before Barad his heart was hardened by God? Chapter 9, verse 12. That doesn't make any sense. If his heart is hardened, God took away his free will. How could he give in? Right? And then problem number two is Cass's problem, which is that after Barad, in the wake of Barad, when Pharaoh changes his mind, who changed whose mind? First, it seems to say that Pharaoh changed his own mind, right? That he hardened his heart. But then, in the beginning of Bo, God says that I'm the one who hardened his heart. So the verses seem to contradict each other. So nothing seems to make sense when it gets to this issue of hardening heart. Let me just conclude this class by summing up our questions at this point, okay? And then these are the things that you have to think about for next week, okay? We're going to go backwards. In Pharaoh's free will, we have the moral problem. Why would God, on a moral basis, decide to interfere with Pharaoh's free will and then punish him for it afterwards? That seems terribly corrupt. Okay, that is problem number one. Problem number two is that we have a textual problem with it, which is that for some reason, God seems to be interested in Pharaoh's will to the extent that he has an unwritten rule that I'm not letting the Jews go unless Pharaoh's consents. Well, if that's God's unwritten rule, then the whole agenda of hardening Pharaoh's heart seems to be at cross purposes with that rule. Why would God harden Pharaoh's heart, seemingly saying that he's not interested in Pharaoh's will one way or the other? He'll make Pharaoh a pawn if he's demanding that Pharaoh give in the first place. If Pharaoh's a pawn, so then just freeze him and let the Jews go. Is Pharaoh's will significant to God, or is it insignificant to God? Plus, once you start getting into the text, the text of the hardening of the heart doesn't seem to make any sense, because in the first time we have God actually hardening his heart in 9:12, right after that he has free will. Plus, immediately after that, right? When Pharaoh hardens his heart again, we have a contradiction in verses as to who is the one responsible for hardening his heart. The truth is, this is just the tip of the iceberg with the problems having to do with hardening the heart. If you go through from A to Z, all the hardened heart stuff, question upon question piles up. So your homework is to try to trace the history of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart and try to see all the difficulties with it. But since I'm in such a nice mood, I'll give you one little hint to unraveling the mystery, right? And the hint is this. You'll find that there are two distinct words used for hardening Pharaoh's heart, and they're not always the same. Okay? One word is kaved lev paro. This Pharaoh's heart is hard, or literally heavy, right? Kaved can mean hard or it can mean heavy, right? And it's spelled the same as kabedet avich vet imecha, which means honor your father and mother, right? So, question is, so what is it that word means? So what's your name?
Andrea.
So actually take Andrea's point for a minute. We'll throw Andrea's point. She's just made her homework a lot harder. And why is it that the Hebrew word, why is it that the Hebrew word for honor, as in honor your father and mother, is the same as the Hebrew word for hard or heavy, like a stone? Why is it that those words are similar? And then ask yourself that once you understand the similarity between those ideas, what does it mean that Pharaoh's heart was hard? Was it honorable? Was it hard? Was it heavy? What's the common denominator between honorable, hard, and heavy? And what does that mean about Pharaoh's heart? Now, heavy and hard and kaved is only one of the words used to describe Pharaoh's heart. The other thing is vayachazak. Chazak really means strong, right? Or powerful, or something like that, or vigorous, right? But that's another phrase which is used to harden your heart. Now, if you have a really bad translation, the translations will not distinguish between the two, and you won't be able to tell it in English. But look in the Hebrew, and always check and see, whenever you have a hardening the heart, glance over to the Hebrew. Is this the kaved kind, or is it the chazak kind? Keep a little notebook. When it's kaved, and when it's chazak, and who's doing the kaved, God or Pharaoh? And who's doing the chazak, God and Pharaoh? And do they follow one another? And they seem to be randomly mixed up. Is there any method to the madness of when kaved is used and when chazak is used, and who's doing what when? Trace it all the way through and see if you can come up with it. Very briefly, just to recap our other questions, we asked about the role of Bechor in the story. What about the role of firstborn? What accounts for the firstborn, for the prominence of the firstborn? The fact that God would say, I'm going to kill the Egyptian firstborn just because I consider the Jews a firstborn in a very literal sense. The fact that the greatest memorial for Pesach in Tefillin is this notion of redeeming the firstborn animal. It's all focusing on that last plague of Makat Bechorah, the very name for the holiday of Pesach, because the fact that we were saved from Makat Bechorah, that our firstborn was saved. Why is firstborn such an important issue with Pesach? And then we had the 3 days, the bargaining, the Pharaoh's will, and also the issue of chosenness, and also the issue of the 10th plague, the halachas having to do with the 10th plague. Is there anything common about those halachas? We've got a lot more to do, so you guys better do a good job with your homework so we don't have to spend too much time on that next time. We will get back to continue with this and pick up our discussion next week, and I'll see you then. This concludes tape one in the series Exodus from Egypt, The Hidden Agenda. The series is continued at this point on tape two.